Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host Mono here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. It's peak cherry blossom time here. Honestly, it really never gets old. I do think that the sakura-flavored food is a bit overrated, though. It doesn't really taste like cherry. I mean, you're really just eating a flower. But if you're not into chowing down on some flowers, there's plenty of games to check out, including the Metroid Prime-inspired first-person grapple hook heavy adventure title, Grappin. I'm joined by Tokyo-based developer Amin Hafidi to chat about the origin of the game, the joy of grapple hooks, and how some major Nintendo-adjacent artists like James Turner and Takaya Imamura got involved. After that, I'll share some closing thoughts on Kirby's Return to Dream Land Deluxe. In the feature, I'm talking about the incredibly unique Dagashiya Game Museum, which houses many electronic and pre-electronic arcade games. These are what people played before video games at small candy shops all over Japan. Let's start by talking to developer Amin Hafidi about Grappin. Tokyo Game Life, only on the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network. The grappling hook. I think it's safe to say it's one of the more iconic tools in all of video gaming. Fortunately, there's a grappling hook heavy title out right now, brought to you by a game developer right here in Tokyo. So, guest, please introduce yourself.
Hello, hello. So, my name is Amin. So, I'm the developer behind Grappin and been living in Japan for like around 10 years now. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me today. Let's hear the pitch of your game. What is Grappin?
Sure. So, Grappin is a first person adventure game on PC. You have a grapple hook called the Grip, which is kind of like an artifact that you have to bring back to the top of the mountain. So that's basically kind of an excuse to have the player going through like a lot of different environments that's going to lead you to the top of the mountain.
Let's talk about the origins of the project a bit. How did you come across this idea? Are there any games that directly inspired it?
What basically started like this whole project was like, I wanted to make a game with Unreal Engine. That's something I wanted to basically learn Unreal. And I was like, okay, so I'm not a programmer, I'm not a designer, so can I make something? I can basically afford to make something with Unreal. And I always wanted to make a first-person game. And as an inspiration, I'm going to code Metroid Prime, which is like a huge inspiration for me. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, maybe my top 10 games, like definitely. If I make a first-person adventure game, I don't need like to make a character and everything around it. It's just basically a camera and everything. So that's going to make things easier for me. And same goes with like the mechanics. I was like, okay, so I'm going to make a first-person game. And what kind of mechanic I'm going to try to do. And I don't know why, but like the grapple hook is like something that was kind of easy to make. Like it just was the first prototype. So I was like, okay, so I'm going to go for it and see how it goes. And yeah, that's pretty much it, man. I mean, the whole background, like the mountain, everything came way after I finished the gameplay base, basically.
I played it at Tokyo Game Dungeon. And the first game I thought of when I was playing it was, yes, Metroid Prime.
When I started working on this project, I wanted to have pretty much the same structure of Metroid Prime. You have your first grip, the first grapple hook, then you get another one that has like a different ability, and then you backtrack in the level and you basically discover new segments and everything. But because I was the only person working on it, I was like, okay, so that's going to be too much work to basically make a game like this. So I'm going to make the whole structure easier, make it simpler as well. And this is why I wanted to have analysis mechanic as well. Like that's something I really like in Metroid Prime. Basically, I mean, I spend so much time doing some analysis around me and like kind of like feeding like a database and everything. That's something I really love. And that's something I wanted to put in the game. But yeah, I mean, I cannot really afford to, afford to do something like this. I'm not sure if you saw that when you played the demo, but there's like two different grapple hook in the game. That's the, you have like the normal one, right? And also like the blue one, the trace grip that allows you to go like faster and farther. And that kind of allows you also to backtrap in the level as well. Like you get this grip. Basically, like there's a main loop of each area. It's like you have to go through the area with the normal grip. And then at the end of the area, you get the blue grip, like the trace grip. And then you backtrap in the level to get new relics, like the collectible in the game. One thing that I kind of forgot from Metroid Prime is kind of like the backtrack idea.
Right. You've done a lot of work for some major game developers in Japan. What inspired you to go the indie route to create Grappin?
I think the thing is like, I wanted to make my own game. I had the chance like to work on like major games. Like that's something like I was really happy about. But at some point, I just want to try to make my own stuff as well. And I think that was like the major inspiration like to start this game. And also trying to learn new technologies as well. I was really interested in Unreal and see how it'd go if I tried to make a game on my own.
What do you think the advantages of the Unreal Engine are compared to some other software that you've used in the past?
The thing I love the most with Unreal is like there's something called Blueprint in Unreal. It basically allows you to program, like to code stuff without knowing programming language, which is something quite huge because I'm not a programmer. It's the main decision why I wanted to go with Unreal. I can basically make stuff with Unreal, which is pretty awesome. I used to make some mods and like maps with Unreal Engine 3. That was, I mean, Blueprint didn't exist back then, but like there was something called Kismet. It was pretty much the same stuff, like visual scripting kind of. And this is the reason why I basically went with Unreal.
Even though you've worked on a lot of games, going indie is a whole different ballgame. What's something you learned about game development once you set out on your own?
The thing is, like, going indie, I'm not completely full indie, actually. I'm more like, I've been working on Grapple in my spare time, basically. Mm. But kind of, I'm sometimes thinking, like, okay, I would love to go full indie at some point. But the thing that was working on Grapple reminds me of something is, like, I really, really enjoy working with other people around me because working on Grapple was quite hard because I was pretty much alone. I was pretty much alone for, like, everything, like, the visuals, the code, game design, everything. And I honestly missed having like people basically working around me and also like asking for help, also like feedbacks and everything. Because when you work too much on one thing, you kind of lose track of everything. It's more like you kind of lose, like you're not even sure if what you're doing is good or bad. And that's something I'm really missing. Working on Grapple was like, okay, so I definitely like work with other people on games.
I want to dive into the mechanics of Grapple a bit more. When I played the demo, one of my favorite mechanics in the game is the little boost you get after you successfully grapple something. It doesn't just snap your character to where you aimed. You actually get some upward momentum. Tell me about this mechanic. Why did you think it was vital for this game?
Yes. So basically when you land on the spot with a grip, I had like to make like everything slow down around you a bit to allow the player to find his next spot, basically. And that was kind of vital because when I started the project, I didn't have any slowdown or anything. But basically player like didn't have time to basically look around them and fine for the next spot. That was kind of like something that was vital for the project as well. But actually, you have an option. If you press start, you have an option to disable that if you want to have some challenge as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
A lot of games utilize grappling hooks. There's, of course, the classic titles like Bionic Commando and Zelda with the hookshot, plus many indie games implement it in some way, like Flint Hook and Grapple Dog. What do you think is the inherent appeal of using a grappling hook in a video game?
That's a good question. And the thing that I really like about grapple hook is kind of like the sense of freedom you have when you use it. Like, it goes like the feeling of being in the air as well. That's something I really like. I really enjoyed it. There's one game also that was a huge inspiration. It was Ocarina of Time, actually, as a hookshot mechanic. Right. That was basically my main inspiration when I created the gameplay for grappling. And I really like the precision as well. Like, yeah, there's no like physics and everything. It's more like you basically shoot and you basically go to the point you aimed, basically. That's something I really like about this kind of mechanics as well. And yeah, it gives us a sense of freedom, being able like to climb and go like this. That's something I really like.
The grappling hook in this game is called the grip, like you've mentioned before. Tell us more about it. How is it different from other video game grappling hooks?
Actually, it's not. I mean, I wouldn't say like it's super different from other games. It's more like trying to. I mean, the grip is kind of like something to help the story and the background as well. Like in the game, it's more like a kind of like an artifact or relic that you have to go back to block the top of the mountain. It's more like you're trying to get some background, but it's like it's still a regular grip.
Right.
But at the very beginning of the project, actually, I was thinking about having the grip to have like some kind of like a personality, that like a character that's going to talk to you and everything. My main inspiration was like actually other Nintendo games. And the other game, I mean, when I started development, I was playing another game called, I mean, pretty sure you know it, Mario Odyssey. And
and
you have like the, I kind of forgot like the name of the hat.
Cappy.
Cappy, yes, exactly. and I was trying to make it like a, kind of having like the grip and telling like the grip telling jokes and everything, trying to be like funny and everything. But I thought that was kind of cringy, to be honest. So basically, I decided to remove all of that, the dialogues and everything around the grip, and just to go around like something more like more simpler, basically.
First-person platforming is a bit rarer in the platforming genre. Why did you decide to utilize a first-person view for Grappin? And what were some of the challenges you came across when developing it as a first-person adventure title?
Because I was starting with Unreal, I'm not a programmer, I'm not an artist, so the easier like way for me was to make like a first person game, because you don't need like to model a cart and everything. That was the easiest way for me to make a game. That was the first reason. The other reason is because I always wanted to make a first person. I wanted to make like, you know, like your first person game, and because I love Metroid Prime and Mirror's Edge and other games as well. And that was a perfect match between my own technical skills and what I wanted to do as well. So this is why I basically go down that route. And I think the most challenging thing in the game was like the body awareness. I had a lot of issues. I was doing playtests like a long time ago, and lots of people had like some issues doing some really simple platforming. Because when you're first person, you cannot have like a body awareness. I'm not sure if that makes sense. You're not even sure if you have a body, kind of.
Right.
So it makes everything difficult. So I had to do a lot of tweaks to basically get this right, like tweaking platform segments and so on.
You've got some illustrious people working on the art for the game. Former Game Freak art director James Turner did the key art for Grappin, and Takaya Imamura, who is known for the art Star Fox, F-Zero, and many others, designed the character. Can you tell us a bit more about how they became involved with the project?
Sure. So actually, I worked at Game Freak some time ago, a long time ago, actually. And I met James there, so we became really good friends. And at some point, I left Game Freak. I was like, okay, so James, you know, I'm making this game, so it'd be interesting, like, maybe making the key art. He was really, really interested into that. He was like, yeah, sure, I'm going to do it. And this is why, basically, I mean, the main key art of the game is, like, from James Turner. But that was such, like, a huge honor to have this art in the game. And for Imamura-san, basically, that was almost 1 year ago, I think. I knew that he basically left Nintendo in 2021, I think. And he opened a Twitter. I was like, okay, so I'm going to try to basically send him a message and see how it goes. I just want to introduce myself. And I was thinking he's not going to reply because that's the person behind the design of F-Zero, Star Fox and everything. That's quite huge, honestly.
Right.
So I sent him a message and he basically replied to me like within 5 minutes, I think. I was really surprised. I was like, wow, okay, that's awesome. So he played the demo. He gave me a lot of feedbacks and that was pretty awesome. And then I was like, okay, so I'd like to have someone to make the character design of the main character and maybe making artworks. He was like super happy to do it. And I was really, really honored, honestly. That was something for me.
When you're collaborating with these artists who have such iconic work, do you feel that it's okay to be a bit hands-off and let them do what they want? Or are you giving them extensive notes on what they need to draw?
I wanted like to let Imamura-san and James doing their thing. I mean, James was like really, really straightforward. Draw like the character from behind. So there was like kind of like an Ice Climber-ish character.
Right.
The only note I gave him was like, please respect the behind of the character. You can basically respect that. I mean, I'm good for everything. James already designed a bit of the character, so you have to stay in line with this. And he did an amazing job. So yeah, that's pretty much it. But you know, it's quite huge to work with these kind of people. I don't want to be staying their way. Like, I just want to leave them. Okay, so do your thing, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the soundtrack. Who did the music for the game and what kind of atmosphere are you hoping to convey with it?
Sure. So the soundtrack has been composed by Benoît Malice. Benoît Malice is a French person living in the south of France. I know Benoît for like, I don't know, like more than 10 years now. And we used to work together like on small prototypes and everything. All prototypes that got scratched in the end. But so, I mean, Grappin is going to be the first game that we're like releasing together, which is, that makes like the game a success in my mind already. But I mean, yeah, that really depends on the area. So you have the first like area we have the game is called like the Valley of Triers, like the starting area. That's where like you're going to learn the ropes, basically. No pun intended. we wanted like to give like a unique atmosphere for each area. So for example, like relax. Also like wanted to convey the nature aspect of the area as well. And when you there's like other areas in the game as well. You have for example like the lava pit, which is kind of like a lava cave kind of. And you wanted the music to be more like action-ish as well, trying to convey like the sense of danger and the pressure as well. And in terms of inspiration, some people actually notice this as well, but you have like a lot of inspiration from Zelda as well, Metroid as well for one area.
Right.
So that's a lot of like inspiration from Nintendo games that we took from.
You've been hitting up indie game events all over Japan and Asia. What has that experience been like, and have you received any interesting feedback from players at these events?
That was honestly amazing. I attended like a few events, Beat Summit for one, Tokyo Game Dungeon, of course, and also like Busan D-Connect in Korea, and among other ones. That was amazing. I'm so grateful for being able to attend these events, get some feedback from the game. And the thing I really liked about these events, like each time I managed to get new friends, like a new developer friends as well, which is which is pretty good, trying to build a community around the game and trying to get involved in the scene a bit more as well. That was really good because even if it doesn't help like the promotional aspect of the game, kind of like allows me like to get feedback basically from people. What I like to do is watching the player playing the game, and after the player is done with the game, I like to have like a quick chat with the player, like, so you like the game, is it like something you didn't like about the game? This really helps me like basically like making the game better.
Right now, the game is currently on Steam and playable on the Steam Deck. Are there any plans to bring it to more consoles in the future?
That's a good question, but there's something in the background. I'm just going to say that, but this is a plan, so I'm not sure that's going to go well or that's going to happen at all, but I'm thinking about it.
Okay, closing question. Now that you've created a completely original franchise and character for video games, there is a non-0% chance that Grappin could appear in Super Smash Bros. In some way. Have you given any thought into what moveset you'd like the main character to have or what stage it should be set on?
Well, that would be awesome for sure. I never thought about this, but I would say like maybe like having the moveset like based on the grapple hook, basically that would be a given for sure. On the stage, I would love to have like the Valley of Trials, having like the mountain in the background and like having like some rocks for it, something like that, trying to have like some environment, like events happening where you fight. That would be something quite amazing. I'm going to wait for like Sakurai-san to give me a phone call and make that happen.
Yeah, it happened before you know it. So you should start preparing now.
Exactly. <yeah.
laughs> So. Awesome. Amin, thanks for joining me. Where can people find you and where can people find Grappin?
Thank you very much. So Grappin is already released on Steam, so you can get it on Steam. You can find me on Twitter as well. I mean, Hafidi on Twitter and Grappin Game for the official Twitter account.
Great. And listeners, the links to everything will be in the podcast description. Amin, once again, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
Check out this show from the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network.
And we're back with another great episode of...
Hold your horses, mister. This is a commercial for our show, Nasty Lamps, not the actual show.
You mean to tell me this is a commercial for our bi-weekly show from game studio Chuhai Labs, where we talk about games, game dev, Japan, and whatever else comes up?
Yep, and it stars me, Kinsey Burke. And also it has my junior co-host, Mark Lentz.
Sup, though?
So catch brand new episodes twice monthly for only 3 easy payments of $420.69.
That doesn't make sense.
Nasty Labs! Only on the Tokyo Beat Network.
I've cleared yet another 2023 Nintendo release, Kirby's Return to Dream Land Deluxe, from HAL Laboratory. If you're not keeping up with the two or so Kirby games released every year, this is the remake of the 2011 Wii game that launched on the Switch in February. I shared some early impressions last time, but now I've cleared the main game, gotten nearly all the achievements in the minigame mode, and rolled credits on the new additional sub-game, Magalore's Epilogue. Haven't really touched the extra mode, but I've seen at least the main stuff the game has to offer. I was pretty on the fence about getting this game when it was announced late last year. I just thought, oh, that's nice, but having never played the original, I didn't really feel any need to jump in. But they just kept showing more and more new things. People who loved the original were hyped, it got great reviews, and I thought, well, Zelda's not out yet, so I'll just grab this. And I'm really glad I did. It's easily in the upper tier of Kirby games and one of his best 2D adventures. I would still put Robobot and Superstar above it, but being right below those isn't too shabby. Shinya Kumazaki is listed as the general director, with Yutaka Watanabe as the director of the game. Watanabe has mostly just worked on level design for past Kirby games, and this is his first stab at directing a title. Kumazaki is pretty much the face of modern Kirby, since he directed the original Return to Dream Land, Triple Deluxe, Robobot, Forgotten Land, etc. So I wonder if Kumazaki is going to step back and hand off directorial duties to Watanabe and others. Or maybe Kumazaki leads the 3D games and Watanabe the 2D ones. But since the series is on the uptick, I wonder if they're going to have even more game projects in the future. Poking at the credits aside, Return to Dream Land Deluxe is an incredibly smart follow-up to Forgotten Land. It may seem like moving backwards, since everyone was so receptive to Kirby in 3D, but it's a fun 2D action platformer that is a good entry point for new Kirby fans to explore what he's been about most of his life. It doesn't really feel basic or dialed down. The game has its own identity and distinct elements. You could point to things like the super abilities and the multiplayer as being the game's gimmicks, but the strength of the game goes beyond these elements. The pacing, the level design, the power-ups, puzzles, and a large amount of content really help flesh out the game to make it a much meatier experience than most 2D Kirby titles. I'm a Kirby fan, but one thing that's always held it back from reaching a wider audience is that they're quite short. Most Kirby titles can be cleared in about 5 hours. I recently beat Kirby's Dream Land on NSO, and it took me 28 minutes. But with Forgotten Land and now this game, I think HAL has figured out how to give players a lot more content, both in the main campaign and in the side stuff, without making it feel bloated or stretched out. I'm at about 15 hours with it now, and I haven't 100%ed it by a long shot. The game's strongest element is the level design. They feel a bit longer than you'd expect, but they don't drag, and each level has its own unique challenge. I never felt like these stages were generic. As the game progresses, you're thrown into a lot of crazy situations and really fun segments. I like the ones where you were given the high jump power, so you had to Superman your way straight up while dodging enemies and finding secret areas. There's some power-specific segments like skating across lava with ice powers or sliding down a bunch of ramps with a rock. Sometimes these are reused, but there's always some new spin on it. It definitely feels like a bit closer to Mario in design, where each level has its own central idea and you see it built upon throughout the course. The super abilities are all great, a basic pick, but I love the sword since you can slice up the terrain to create new areas. The ice one is also really good because you turn into a giant snowball and have Kirby ramp over things. All of these segments are followed by, I don't know how to describe these, like dimensional portal segments. You're thrown into a level with an advancing wall that will crush you, and you've got to navigate the area with no powers. So many of these are really creative in how they utilize Kirby's innate abilities. A lot of inhaling and blowing out stars, but they're used in ways you normally don't see in a typical Kirby stage. It's fun to sort of depower Kirby and see how he fares. All the levels have such a good rhythm to them. You've got the main idea of the stage, then every now and then they will throw in some super abilities, the dimensional portal area, a boss, and so on. The game keeps its levels fresh. Is it still incredibly easy? Yes. You'll rack up 50 lives in no time, and probably die maybe 5 times total, if that. But difficulty is not the point of Kirby. It's all about creativity, relishing the use of Kirby's powers, and the spectacle. I always say this, but Kirby games are action titles, not traditional platformers. A major hook for this game is the 4-player mode, but honestly, I played it all solo. Yet, I think that further emphasizes just how good this game is. It doesn't really need to be played with others to have fun. The levels are made for solo players, and everyone else is just a fun addition. I never played Star Allies, but a common criticism is the over-reliance of needing to control multiple characters or having everyone in sync. Here, the multiplayer just seems like a fun addition and not something like the game is built upon, so don't worry, solo players. Once you clear the main game, you get access to the biggest sub-game, Magalore Epilogue, the Interdimensional Traveler. This takes place after the events of the ending, and you take control of Magalore, who is like a wizard or something. I'm a Kirby fan, but I often get lost on Kirby lore. But the point is, you play as a different character who has its own unique power set compared to the Pink Puff. Like the main game, you traverse levels and try to reach the end, but your abilities are so different. You've got these directional magic projectiles you can shoot, a shield, other special attacks like the ability to summon spikes, you can phase through walls. The controls are pretty similar to Kirby, but you've got access to a whole lot of new tools. You can also upgrade these abilities by spending orbs you find in the level. All this orb gathering also ties into one of the more unexpected elements, a combo system. If you attack enemies fast enough, it will rack up a combo and then you receive some bonus orbs. Don't think of it like some sort of complex Devil May Cry combat system. It's really just hitting enemies over and over again in rapid succession. It does get fun though once you buff up to have more abilities and make the combo timer a bit more lax. I've strung up 50-hit combos before, and the levels are often designed to be frantic and fast-paced, so you are always in a position to boost your score. Since there are no real puzzles or hidden collectibles, the level here definitely feels a bit more frantic and combat-heavy. You couldn't just slap Kirby in here. They're all built around Magalore's toolset. This mode is an unexpected yet excellent new addition. We've seen some stuff where you can play through the game again as Meta Knight, but it's way more extensive than you'd expect for post-game content. Unique stages, unique mechanics, unique enemies, and the final boss is appropriately epic. Some true cosmic horror stuff here. Even though there's no collectibles in this mode, you can still 100% it by getting the highest ranking on each stage, which I do believe unlocks something, so go for it. Like Metroid, Kirby is a game that you get the most out of by 100%ing it. And of course, there are minigames in the Merry Magoland portion of the game. This is easily the best minigame collection for a Kirby game, and honestly, maybe for a game in general. It's the greatest hits of over 30 years of Kirby minigames. It has both Checkerboard Chase and Samurai Kirby, which are in the running for the greatest minigame ever. Both are incredibly faithful to their original versions. Checkerboard Chase certainly feels different since you have more accurate control of your character compared to the N64 version. There's a lot more threading the needle and narrow escapes as opposed to the N64 game, which locked your position in a bit more. I think there is merit to the controls being a bit stiff, since that means you're really committing to your attacks. But I'd say the new version is just as good. The brand new minigame, Magalore's Tome Checkers, honestly, is probably the worst minigame, but the others are all excellent. I don't like Smash Ride though, but the others, that's where the fun is. All these support 4 players as well. Sadly, it's all local co-op except for the Battle Royale-esque Samurai Kirby 100. I know adding online to any game is a huge ordeal, but this is definitely a title that would have benefited from 4-player online, both in the main campaign and in the minigames. These games are just so genuinely good, and I'd love to try my luck against randoms online. One excellent addition I enjoyed is the tour where you play 4 random minigames and earn points throughout each round. Whoever has the most points at the end wins. The AI is no slouch either, so there's some good back and forth jockeying between the players. But again, I'd love to play this mode online. The game really exceeded my expectations. It went from an easy skip to an easy recommendation. If you're a Kirby fan, you'd love this game. If you got into Kirby with the Forgotten Land, I think this is a very good next step. There's a lot of content and all the modes have something interesting and fun. I kind of wonder what's next for Kirby remakes. We've seen Dream Land, Superstar, and now Return to Dream Land remakes. Maybe Triple Deluxe is next? I wonder if HAL would ever pull a Mario and have a distinct line between a 3D and a 2D series. I think you could still make a brand new 2D Kirby game if you've got an interesting take on it. There will always be a subset of people who are only into 3D Kirby games, but HAL has a lot of options now, so I'm excited to see where they take the franchise in the future. Game time is up. Now the feature on the Dagashiya Game Museum. This episode's feature is about the Dagashiya Game Museum in Tokyo, a mini-museum slash arcade dedicated to electronic and pre-electronic arcade games. Think video games before video games. I recently wrote about it on Time Extension, but I promised not to just read my article verbatim here. There's always podcast-exclusive content for my loyal listeners. I may have mentioned it before on the podcast, but it refers to an old-school candy store, mostly from the Showa era, aka early 20th century, to the late 1980s. These were small, crowded shops that kids would often visit after school. It sold a lot of cheap, sugary candy for about 10 yen or so. It's an iconic element of Showa-era nostalgia. They don't really exist anymore, as most were replaced by the ever-present convenience store, but there are some places that mimic the atmosphere of an old-school dagashiya. The top floor of Super Potato in Akihabara actually has a shop set up just like one, which is probably the number one dagashiya visited by tourists, believe it or not. Shockingly, I did not grow up in Japan in the Showa era, so the nostalgia is a bit lost on me, but I absolutely see its appeal. You're in the Japanese countryside, there's a small shop inside a traditional building, you're a kid with 30 yen, you buy some candy and chat with your friends, the shop is run by an old man, there's cicada singing, there's probably a million Japanese TV shows where there's some flashback to kids hanging out at a dagashiya without a care in the world. Now, you can only sell so much candy, so HAL else can these stores sap the wallets of elementary school children? Games, of course. Many dagashiya had arcade games in them, likely only one or two, and these were small, compact machines that could fit in such a narrow space. There's a term in Japan called dagashiya cab, referring to a custom-built arcade cabinet that is much smaller than normal and has no decoration on the sides. These were custom-built so they could easily fit into the corner of a candy shop. However, dagashiya games go way beyond just unique arcade cabinets. There are many arcade games that predate video games, or were developed alongside them, yet aren't video games as we know them. Many of them were analog, think some variation of pinball, or just had flashing lights that players could manipulate. The games you'd find in a dagashiya aren't exactly the same titles you'd stumble across in a Sega arcade, for example. Now that we've got a bit of backstory, let's look at the actual museum. It was founded in 2009 by software developer Akihito Kishi. He was concerned that the games of his youth were disappearing, so he set out to create a space for them to be preserved and appreciated. He has dozens of machines in the store, and even more in storage, and he even rents them out for TV and movies. The Dagashiya Game Museum is located in Itabashi Ward in northern Tokyo. I'm trying to think of what Itabashi is famous for, but I'm really drawing a blank. They have a fireworks festival every year that I believe is pretty popular. Pretty much every city or area in Tokyo has at least a fireworks festival or some sort of shrine that makes it worth visiting. But most people don't stumble into Itabashi. The museum isn't too far away from the station, and you'll be walking down a traditional Japanese shotengai shopping street before you arrive at your destination. The outside is very nondescript. The only thing possibly giving away that games are inside are some ancient gashapon machines outside the shop. Even the signboard for the museum is very old school. It's just a piece of lacquered wood with a name written on it in ink. It's also right across the street from a shrine, so it definitely feels like the perfect place to do a bit of time traveling. You buy a ticket from a vending machine outside the museum. Entry is 300 yen, but once you give your ticket to Mr. Kishi, you get a cup filled with tokens or medals. Some machines take yen, but others take these medals. So the museum is not just a walk around and look type of place, but one where you can actually interact with all the machines. It really feels more like an arcade, since information on each machine is non-existent. You're there to play and learn through playing. I do wish there was like a plaque or something about each machine explaining its history, but maybe there's not enough space and these things get moved around often. Since you're given free tokens, you'll likely be drawn to the metal games in the back of the shop where you can play for quote-unquote free. Now, the point of metal games is to get more medals. You can exchange these for prizes back in the day, but at the museum, there's nothing to gain, so don't feel bad about blowing through all your medals. Most of the metal games revolve around betting, so a lot of pure luck is involved. Despite the player input being minimal, many of these machines are incredibly unique in design. There is G-Circuit from 1977. Yes, 1977. The cab is a big board with different cars and positions laid out, and after placing your bet, the lights on the board flash to show who won. There is some strategy to this game, like some cars are faster but you win less coins. You can also bet on which car gets which position, so it's way more than just a win-lose type of situation. There's a lot of these electronic flashing lights type of games. It's interesting to see how they convey movement and changes in the scenario solely through just lighting up characters on the board. Another metal game is Kame-san Usagi-san, or The Tortoise and the Hare. Here you pick a winner, the tortoise or the hare. Now, I know you may be leaning towards the tortoise here, but realistically, I think it's 50-50 in the game. The machine has a sign panel with the tortoise on one side and the hare on the other, and after you place your bet, it rapidly spins. When you stop the machine, it will then flip to the winner. I really love machines that have some sort of analog component to it. I was genuinely impressed by how fast the sign spun around. It looked like it was just going to fly out of the machine. For Nintendo fans, there's one metal game that will catch your eye, Mario Roulette. Yes, our good friend Mario makes an appearance in the museum. This is a 1991 arcade game developed by Konami, of all people. As you can guess, it's a roulette game. Some blocks with different power-ups spin around, and you try to match three. That's it. That's the game. Not a whole lot going on here in terms of gameplay, but it does use these Super Mario World graphics, and the cabinet has some Mario art I've never seen before. I've been to my fair share of retro arcades in Tokyo, yet I've never encountered this machine. The Dagashi Game Museum is just filled with lots of cabs you can only find here. There's a Takoyaki Plinko type of machine, one where you play an electronic version of Rock, Paper, Scissors. There are just so many weird input methods or doodads attached to these cabs that make them interesting, despite the gameplay being kind of shallow. If you've blown through all your medals, you can try your hand at games that do take your hard-earned yen. Fortunately, many of these games are incredibly cheap, only about 10 yen per play. Even if you lose in 5 seconds, I think it's absolutely worth trying them out just to get a feel of how they played. Some of these machines have collabs with other IPs like Astro Boy and even Disney. The one I played the most was a Gundam game from Konami. Yes, Konami appeared yet again. This is a machine from 1982 and has an even older Konami logo right on the cab. It's basically an electronic board game where you and the enemy Zaku are trying to reach the end. You roll a dice by pressing a button, and that determines whether you or the enemy moves and how many spaces. Again, the gameplay leaves a lot to be desired. You're really just pressing a button over and over again. But the sound effects, the art, the vibrant colors, I can see this being a bit mind-blowing to a hardcore Gundam fan in the early 1980s. One flashing light game I really enjoyed is called Yamanobori, or Mountain Climbing. It originally came out in 1981, but it was so popular that it got a re-release with LED lights in 2011. I believe this is probably one of the more iconic Dagashi games. Basically, you're trying to hike up a mountain, but it's filled with obstacles displayed via flashing red lights. You press a button to navigate your light across the board, dodging the red lights. It seems very simple, and it is, but it requires some excellent timing and planning to succeed. When you just barely dodge 5 snakes in a row or cross a collapsing bridge, it's actually quite exciting. This is something that I think a lot of speedrunners would like, believe it or not. If you're not into lights, there are more analog games to try out. The Disney one is what I can only describe as some sort of elaborate pinball machine. There are these pins all around the board, and then you throw a steel ball via a lever to the next area. There are three levers, and shockingly, I got the ball all the way to the end, albeit a tremendous amount of luck was involved. I think that's probably the biggest takeaway from these types of games. Many of them are completely luck-based and are just there to suck up your yen. You could argue that arcade games in general are guilty of the same thing, but I certainly think it's more egregious here. You can absolutely understand how a lot of these machines went the way of the dinosaur once more complex video games entered the scene. There is one true blue video game at the museum, Galaga, which is inside a tiny customized red cabinet. Galaga is great and all, but really you come here to play games you can't find anywhere else. There are some machines where the playing piece is your actual coin. In Hopupopu Goku from Taito, you insert a 10 yen coin, and then it appears inside the game. You have to navigate your coin across obstacles by turning knobs and levers, and if you get it to the end, you get your coin back. The more likely outcome is that you'll hurl your coin into a hole after about 2 seconds, but practice makes perfect. When I visited the arcade on a breezy Saturday afternoon, I was wondering if I would be the only patron. But surprisingly, there were about a half dozen or so people there, both kids and adults. The Dagashi Game Museum definitely offers an experience you can't find anywhere else in Tokyo. So it attracts a lot of people who are either A, nostalgic for this era, or B, curious about these oddities. I assume most patrons are going to fall into the B camp, and that shows the strengths of these unique machines. There's really nothing like them today. If you're into gaming history, you'll certainly marvel at all these old Konami and Taito machines that are in great condition. And you probably won't see people writing extensively about these cabs in English. If you're not in Tokyo, the owner of the shop does have a YouTube channel where he plays the games, so you can get a feel of what they actually look like. If you're a tourist in Tokyo, this shop is pretty out of the way to just swing by. But if you're a hardcore retro gamer or interested in video game or arcade history, I'd say it's certainly a must visit. You could probably spend 30 minutes to an hour there or more, depending on how into the games you get. The museum also sells a lot of cheap candy and ramen, so you can also partake in the other Dagashi aspects if you so choose. If you do pop by there and you're hungry, Itabashi has a pretty good Okinawa restaurant close to the station. Sorry, I totally forgot the name. Just look for the signs of Okinawa food outside the restaurant. That's it for the feature. Now for the news. News time. It's pretty light this week, so let's keep it short. Namco Tokyo opens up in Tokyo Kabukicho Tower on April 14th. It looks like a mix of a bar, an arcade, and various Namco-related shops. There's even a DJ area, but it seems to be a virtual DJ and not someone in an actual booth. There's a Gashapon area, Crane Games, Taiko, of course, and the One Piece card game store. The One Piece card game seems to be getting pretty popular both in Japan and America. TCG seems like a really impossible field to enter in 2023, but if you have an IP as big as One Piece, you might as well try. Namco Tokyo seems pretty similar to the Namco Cross Store in Yokohama, which I featured in an earlier episode of the podcast. If you're not paying attention to all the latest buildings in Tokyo, the Tokyo Kabukicho Tower is a massive entertainment complex / hotel that's set to open up next month. They've been working on it for years, and the sheer size of it makes it stand out as a major Shinjuku landmark. This seems to be the biggest game-related shop in the tower for now, but I'm absolutely going to check it out and look forward to a feature in a future episode. And more games were added to NSO. Game Boy got Kirby's Dream Land 2 and Burger Time Deluxe. SNES got Side Pocket, a pool game from Data East, and NES got the Namcot version of Xevious. No GBA or N64 titles, which is a bit surprising. I mean, don't you want people to sign up for the expansion pass? Dream Land 2 is a wonderful game and much better than Dream Land 1, and it's better than 3, honestly, so I guess technically it is the best of the weird cross-generation trilogy. It's also the first Shimomura-directed Kirby title, and you've got all his games on NSO now, which is pretty awesome. It's worth playing if you need more Kirby in your life, and who doesn't? I was never a big Burger Time guy, but I did play a bit of the Game Boy version, and it's a good translation of the game to that hardware. Also, look up the Japanese box art for Burger Time Deluxe. It's way better than the US one. Side Pocket, I legitimately have never heard of, but I'm always impressed at Nintendo's ability to pull out the most obscure games from nowhere and just throw them onto NSO. I want to say the NES version of Xevious is quite good, or at least it was massively popular in Japan. No Japanese exclusives this time around? I really do want some Japan-only games on NSO, especially for the Game Boy. Give us Starfy. Give us No 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 Puzzle Chalion. Anything, please. The next Splatfest was announced for April 1st, which is real, Nessie, Aliens, or Bigfoot. Something tells me it's going to be a bit lopsided. Who believes in Nessie over aliens? I feel like one of these should have been Ghost, like Ghost, Aliens, and Bigfoot. The Pokemon Splatfest has been the best one so far, since it was quite balanced in terms of voting. If you want some free sea snails, I'd pick the alien side. As a side note, the download cards for the expansion pass are on sale now in Japan, and I've seen some train ads for it too. Splatoon is still kicking over here, and I'm sure it will slide into the top 10 sellers of the Switch sometime later this year. Lush is teasing a Super Mario Bros. Movie collaboration for April 14th. If you're not familiar with the brand, they're famous for their bath bombs and various lotions. It's quite popular in Japan. In fact, I don't think I ever saw a Lush store in the US, so initially I assumed it was a Japanese brand. This place is really my go-to when I need to buy my wife a present and I don't have any ideas. They've shown off a question mark block bath bomb, and I assume more designs are coming, maybe like a mushroom or a fire flower. And sticking with some other Mario news, LEGO Donkey Kong was teased for later this year via a live LEGO presentation. I mean, it looks like a LEGO version of Donkey Kong. No sort of DK-specific set was shown off, but I have to imagine it's coming. I'm not a big LEGO person, but I assume these are selling quite well. I'd be curious to just nab a LEGO Mario to put on my shelf, but he only comes in a set. Maybe they will release a mini LEGO Mario keychain down the line. I'm always on the lookout for more keychains I don't need. Well, that's all this time around. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. Just say great and hit that 5-star button. The podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter or Instagram. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on April 9th. See you next time. Matane!